Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Wednesday. Is it Wednesday? Oh, man. It's Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. You'd think I would have realized that because I have Kelly Gaumont here.
Hi, Jeff. Are you sure it's Wednesday?
I am, because you're here.
Okay.
That's how the universe works. And I'm so glad you're here. Also, John Martellaro, I'm glad you are here too.
I just beamed in.
I know. I can still smell the ionization of the atmosphere from the transporter beam.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It smells strikingly similar to petrichor. Hey.
Wow. That was some nerd acrobatic right there. That was
thank
impressive.
You. Thank you. And there's like three people out there that are like, oh, yes. Hey, we have a sponsor today, and that sponsor is ScreenFloat from Eternal Storms. We'll talk about them soon. But first, we need to talk about John's Black Box. And by John's Black Box, what I really mean is a new law that Germany, I believe, wants to enact that would require cars that have autonomous driving systems to include a black box recorder. And John, you've been doing some research into this, so fill us in, please.
One of the issues that is of great concern with autonomous cars is who's driving the car and what the liability issues are. So if you're a passenger and you're not paying much attention, you're sitting in the back playing cards, you have no involvement, then the car's in autonomous mode has full responsibility for your safety and therefore liability. If you're sitting behind the wheel and sort of paying attention, the question is how much contribution is being made by the car and what the allocation of responsibility is. And of course, if you're driving the car in full control, then we default to the original insurance system. So one of the ways that we can determine who's in charge of the car for liability purposes is, as this article describes, Germany wants to have these autonomous cars fitted with a black box that can log the period of time when the car is in full control and when it's not. And that's a great idea. I wonder whether the United States will follow. There's certainly no lack of discussion in the United States about these issues. There's a really good article at the Insurance Information Institute that talks about some of the key factors that are involved in this transition. It's very complicated and very tricky. And one of the things that serve as roadblocks to this is this transition period, because there will be a transition period. We have assistance now at varying levels. There's the SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, has defined five levels of autonomy. And the cars are going to translate through that phase as they become more and more capable. And as the drivers go along with it, it's going to require a lot of training. It's going to require a lot of tracking of the car's performance. The Insurance Institute is going to be dealing with issues like, well, the number of accidents are going to go down. So liability insurance will go down on the driver's behalf. But there will be insurance costs for the manufacturer, who's going to have to assume some liability in full autonomous mode. So there's insurance issues to work out, and liability issues, and cost issues. These cars get more complicated, and as the accidents get reduced, it's going to cost more and more money to replace these complex components if there is a sort of a fender bender. So the best way to do that is to, you know, fully track the car's performance with some sort of car flight data recorder that logs what's going on, and then the courts can sort out what really happened. So that's where we are, and I'm hoping the United States government... Now, there's no dearth of information about government regulation and government oversight, and the states are controlling this, and the federal government is getting involved. The Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox is reviewing some policy for the NHTSA. And so the guidelines are out, but what's cool is that Germany has taken this formal step of actually doing the black box logging, and perhaps that will become commonplace.
You know, on one hand, this sounds like a really useful tool, and on the other hand, all I can think is privacy invasion.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of where I'm at.
You know, everything is tracked. If you buy an airline ticket, it's tracked. If you shop for something, that's tracked. If you buy something on Amazon, that's tracked. If you make a phone call, that's tracked. Everything you do these days is tracked. I think the question is how it's used, what privacy considerations are in place, and how easy it is to aggregate information in a useful way that becomes threatening.
So all right, so how long before law enforcement agency says we need full access to someone's black box or everyone's black box to protect people, because don't forget the children, also terrorists?
Well, I think the cat's out of the bag. You know, it's like saying, well, we should rip out all of this internet capacity of the iPhone and just go back to, you know, analog flip phones. We're never going back. So the only way to deal with
it, but I want to make them work for it.
Proper regulation and protections built.
They should have to earn it, and that's all I'm asking. I'm with Jeff on this one. Is, you know, that's the first thing I see happening. The other thing that I think about on this is how early, like, this seems really early to be getting into this. So I feel like either somebody has a lot more information about how far along these programs are than I have. Or it's just somebody going, it's somebody for once trying to get ahead of the curve when it comes to legislation and technology, because so far it's been really behind. So it would be nice if maybe somebody was just trying to get out ahead of that for once, but I still kind of feel icky about it, I guess. And also I feel kind of weird about self-driving cars in general. Like, it's one thing to passenger. Like, if I'm in a car and someone else is driving it, but I'm under the impression that someone else is actively driving, and I really like to drive, and that's not a thing I'm going to give up easily. So maybe at some point in my life, it will be an easier thing to kind of get into. But right now, I really don't want that to be a thing that happens, I guess. Well, I like driving.
There's lots of challenges for modern drivers. There's the rates of speed. There's the temptations of audio. There's texting and audio calls. There is a lot of stress on people with congestion, and congestion causes desperation when it comes to maneuvers. I was driving along a particular section of I-25, and we were approaching a turnoff to a toll road. And I was predicting what was going to happen. I said, you know, this person doesn't know where they're going. They're following me, and I'm heading for the toll road where you got to pay. And they were following me for miles and just kind of locked into my car. And I'm thinking, you know what? There's no way this person knows that they have to veer left to stay on I-25. And we get to the intersection, you know, where there's that apron section. And I look in the rearview mirror, and it's like, whoosh, they're making a 90-degree, you know, sharp turn across the apron, trying to avoid getting onto this toll road. People in congested regions aren't willing to pay the price of their inattention and go the extra 2 miles to turn around and start over again, which causes a radical maneuver in order to avoid the results of their inattention. So congestion and speeds and technology have put great strain on modern drivers, and I can see how accidents would be reduced with these autonomous or semi-autonomous assistance devices. They're coming. As for access to the black box, I'd like to see a regulation that says access can only be obtained by law enforcement when there's been an accident, and otherwise access is not accessible. That's something that has to be worked out. I'm not optimistic that those strict regulations will be passed in the United States.
Well, the other thing they could do with the regulations or laws when they create those is to restrict what the black box collects. So instead of saying log every single thing the car is doing, how fast did it accelerate, how long were they going at this speed, how sharply did they turn, or how hard did they brake, just have it log, here's when the car was put into autonomous or semi-autonomous mode, here's how long it was in that mode, here's when it was deactivated, and here's when we detected that the driver took over control of the vehicle.
My sense of that is that the technical needs to establish liability would be so extensive that that wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, which I fear leads to a potential for government abuse by accessing data that maybe they shouldn't have. And then also the potential for someone to hack into a system and collect all kinds of personal information about car drivers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hackability. That's important. That hasn't been discussed much. I mean, we've seen vague references to certain cars that are amenable to being hacked externally, requires sophisticated equipment, and only some cars are susceptible to it. And we've seen that in movies where somebody has a laptop and they take remote control of the car and crash the opponent. But the larger issue is, I think, the human adaption to these systems, the rate at which we do it. Car companies seem to be rushing headlong to develop this technology quickly. And as I said recently, I think there would be no normal rush to this. It's something that should be taken with seriousness and care and methodology. But I think the race of competition and the exponential change in technologies are going to cause a race to these kinds of cars to be brought to the market early. And it's not that the Insurance Institute isn't looking at these. I think the insurance companies are having a lot of discussion about it in concert with state governments and federal government. I think it's going to be a kind of a social issue, because there'll be a mixture at first of cars on the road. And there'll be people who don't completely understand how to use their system in semi-autonomous mode. There'll be social issues with allocation of liability and what insurance rates you should pay, sort of a psychological factor, you know. You know, the automotive companies will probably work out some sort of deal with the insurance companies to extend some sort of risk to the passenger, you know, it's through liability agreements. Insurance companies probably would be that intermediary, but whether the customer will be fully protected and the manufacturer has to pay full liability for any problem, that's kind of a pipe dream, I think.
All right. So I have one more question before we move on. And this question I'm actually posing to our listeners and not you or Kelly. And the question is, if there was legislation that required a black box recorder to be in autonomous and semi-autonomous vehicles, and Apple makes a car that supports these features, would you be less willing to purchase a vehicle from Apple knowing it had a black box built into it? So let me know. You can shoot me a message on Twitter. That would be at TMO Daily. You can send me emails. That would be observations@macobserver.com. And you can leave comments in the show notes. I'll be checking to see what you guys think because I really want to know. I'm curious to see who's on board with black boxes and who isn't. All right. And I mentioned earlier that we have a sponsor, and that sponsor is ScreenFloat from Eternal Storms. And ScreenFloat, it's a screen capture app for your Mac. And I talked yesterday about how when you take a screenshot, it actually keeps that captured image floating above all the other windows on your desktop, which can be really handy if you need to reference information from a screenshot while you're doing something else. But another cool thing that it does, there's actually an app interface that goes along with this. So as you're taking screenshots, it's organizing your screenshots for you, so you have all the thumbnails. And then you can select screenshots and do other things from directly in the app's interface. So you can send images on to other people, and or you can tell an image to open in a specific application. If you need to work with it, say, in an image editor, you can just do all that stuff directly from their interface. So it's a really cool, easy-to-use repository for all the screenshots that you're collecting as well. So go check it out. You can look at ScreenFlow and check out a demo on their website, eternalstorms.at/screenfloat. And give it a shot. And my guess is that you're going to like it. And when you do, then it's only going to cost you $8.99 for the app, which is a pretty sweet deal considering how useful it is. So that's eternalstorms.at/screenflow. Go check out the app because it's pretty cool. And go ahead, Kelly.
Well, I want to point out, you may have heard, particularly if you listen to many podcasts, you may have heard people refer to ScreenFlow, F-L-O-W, and we're talking about an app called ScreenFloat, F-L-O-A-T, as in root beer. So I just want to make sure people are aware that there is a difference, because both of them seem like they sound really close to the same. And I know when we had mentioned before that we had a sponsor, that was my first thought was, do you mean ScreenFlow? And so I want to make sure people know that that's a completely different application, and that the one that we're talking about is from Eternal Storms.
And it's a pretty cool little app, and only $8.99. So go check it out. All right. The other thing I want to talk about today actually ties in with graphics. And this is a file format that Google has created. It's called WebP. So it's W-E-B-P. And the claim to fame for WebP is that it offers you comparable image quality at a smaller file size, and it can handle transparency, and it can handle animation. It does lossless and lossy compressions. So it's an all-in-one file format that could potentially replace JPEG, PNG, and GIF. And why am I bothering to tell you about this? Well, it's because it turns out that Apple has added support to macOS Sierra and iOS 10 betas for WebP. And what that means is that if a website can serve you images in the WebP format, the site should load faster and use less data. And that's a cool thing. But I'm having a small issue here, because there really hasn't been widespread support for WebP. I mean, in 2013, Mozilla did a study where they looked at a bunch of different formats and decided not to support WebP because they couldn't see any significant improvements in supporting that over JPEG, PNG, and GIF. But it would really be
ago?
In addition to. So that was in 2013. So it's not like this is a brand new format.
Somebody went, not so much.
Right.
Okay.
But Facebook is supporting WebP for at least some of their graphics. And YouTube supports WebP for some of its graphics. So there are sites that are using it, but here's the deal.
Well, I'm not surprised that YouTube is. I mean,
of course.
Right.
Right. So, but here's the deal. Your web browser has to support WebP before you can see any graphics that that are in that format. The website needs to be able to tell the difference between browsers that support WebP and those that don't. So it needs to have different versions of graphics depending on which web browser it's serving to. And then developers and designers need to understand WebP so that they can actually create the graphics.
I got to weigh in on this.
Okay.
First of all, who thought of this name? It's crazy.
Thank you.
All the jokes running through my mind right now. I can't stay on the air.
It's because you're a proper gentleman.
I would rather have associations of engineers, professional organizations, define standards rather than one particular company promote a standard.
Okay.
It doesn't seem right, and it is open to abuse and things that are unexpected or tricks. And third, Does it solve the problem of text versus graphics? The reason we have PNG and JPEG is because JPEG handles smooth graphics a lot better than text, and PNG handles text pretty well, much better than JPEG does. So does it solve that problem? I haven't heard a discussion about that. So I have lots of questions, including the crazy name, and I'm just kind of circumspect about this and not sure it's a great idea.
My knee-jerk reaction is it's from Google, so I already feel kind of icky about it.
Icky. Perfect word.
First off, that name is just dumb. I got to get that on the table. I'm with you, John, on that 100%. Like, you couldn't do better than that. Second of all, I don't understand why it was needed. And so all I'm left with is Google and their long and storied history of less than savory intentions when it comes to certain things. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I think of is, well, it's Google. What do they want with my image? Number one. Number two, what happens if I upload that image from my computer to my web server, for example, if I'm building a website and I do that? Does it include location data from where I uploaded it? Like, if I created it on my computer, it's not going to have location metadata. Are they going to require that because Google wants to track everybody? Remember the whole thing with Waze and all of that. So what I feel like there's a piece of this that we just don't know about yet. And part of the only thing that makes me feel like maybe Google in this case actually truly believes they're just making the world better is that Apple is supporting it. Like, I feel like if there was anything truly unsavory happening here, that Apple would have no truck with this. And I can't guarantee that, but that's the feeling that I have based on the history I have of professionally following these companies as part of my job, is knowing what they're doing, what they're up to, what they're about, and finding out why they're up to what they're up to in most cases. And when we find that out about Google, it tends to be kind of yucky. And when we find it out about Apple, it tends not to be. And so I feel like there has to be another piece to this that I just don't know. But in the meantime, like, I'm
hope
sticking
for the
to
best,
JPEGs.
Prepare for the worst.
Yeah, I'm there sticking to JPEGs and well, who am I getting? GIFs and PNGs for now. Partly because regardless of how you say it, GIF is a better name than WebP.
So, all right. So, another bit of information that people will probably want to know. This is an open standard that Google created. So, So it's not like they've created this proprietary thing and everyone has to buy into Google in some way.
Right. But if you're not on the beta program, the only way you can see that image is Chrome.
That's true. No, Opera supports it also.
Oh, okay.
And also, it's part of the beta as a test. That does not mean that WebP support will be part of macOS Sierra or iOS 10 this fall when they officially ship. But it's a possibility.
They're playing with it. Yeah, and that's literally, we put this in a beta just to kind of see what happens, is the only thing that keeps me from 100% dismissing this stupid new image format out of hand.
Yeah.
And yes, I said that, and I know in 10 years we're all going to be using it, and we're all going to be sending them to each other from behind the wheels of our self-driving cars. But just to bring the whole thing full circle of stuff that I don't want to do right now, that's
they're
probably
coming
going
to drive
to
me away, haha, hoo hoo.
Yeah, but with a graphic file format that uses less space. So at least you have that going for you, John. Hey, we're out of time, so we have to wrap up.
Okay.
Kelly, thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
John, thank you for being here as well.
You bet. Beaming out.
Awesome. And Eternal Storms Screen Float, thank you for being our sponsor today. Head over to their website, eternalstorms.at/screenfloat, and check out their awesome screen capture app. It is pretty cool. Listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.